It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In last week's election, Republicans held onto a majority in Wisconsin State Senate with 18 seats compared to 15 for Democrats.
Previously, Republicans had held a supermajority controlling 22 of the state's Senate's 33 seats.
The Republican caucus elected a new leader to a top position in the Senate, selecting Mary Felskowski of Tomahawk as Senate president.
Felskowski is a state senator representing Wisconsin's 12th Senate district in northern Wisconsin, including Marinette, Oneida, and Vilas counties. She joins us now for a look at top priorities for the next 2 years in the Senate, including the next state budget. Senator Felskowski, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Before we dig into particular issues, Senator Felskowski, our reporters were following candidates on the campaign trail, and in some competitive seats, they were hearing things from Democrats and Republicans along the lines of, hey, I'm somebody who can work with the other side. I could be bipartisan. They're saying it as a selling point. Do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation, both among your colleagues in the state legislature and with a Democratic governor, Republican-controlled legislature?
So I think, you know, we saw candidates, the Democratic candidates that ran, whether it was Jody, Sarah, Mr. Wall up in the Green Bay area, you know, they ran on tax cuts. They ran on backing police, fire, and those are very much Republican priorities. So I'm hoping when those tax cuts come forward, put forward by Republicans, and, you know, backing police, fire, EMS, criminal justice, public safety, I'm hoping that they stay true to their campaign promises and that they vote with us. And, you know, that they promise their citizens and their constituents that that's how they felt during the campaign. And I hope that they do intend to work in that bipartisan manner with their Republican colleagues and stay true to those campaign promises. So I very much hope that we can work in a bipartisan manner on the issues that were most important to constituents.
A cynical listener might have heard that statement and said, you're hoping that you get lots of bipartisanship from Democrats. Do you see opportunities where you can meet them halfway?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think what people forget is that 94% of the bills that pass in this House pass bipartisan. You wouldn't know it by the media, but we do pass a lot of bipartisanship measures in this House. I'm looking forward to working with the governor, you know, on a lot of issues, roads, but we are not going to move away from conservative values. You know, we're not going to do a lot of new government programs. That's not a conservative value. But where we can find common ground, absolutely. Healthcare, you know, bringing down the cost of healthcare in the state, you know, investing in our infrastructure, investing in schools. Those are all very much bipartisan issues, and we will look forward to working on those issues.
Let's dig more into those issues you just brought up. Healthcare costs. What do you see as opportunities for state government to help people dealing with both the cost of healthcare and access as we see some hospitals in rural parts of the state closing?
You just opened up a two-hour conversation for me because this is one of the things that I am most passionate on. So we've seen in other areas of the nation as well under, you know, the Trump administration the last time before he left, he put hospital price transparency into place. We then seen governor in Colorado and a very bipartisan working group in Colorado pass hospital price transparency. Now, it came online early last year. And we're seeing how that has really started to take effect and put competition into effect, where people actually know the cost of their health care before they have a procedure done. I mean, I just appeal to everyone. What do you purchase that you don't know the cost before you purchase it? Two-thirds of the people in the state of Wisconsin, actually 80%, are insured on ERISA plans. If employers knew what costs were, they could actually build out low-cost, high-quality plans, because that's the one thing that we have found is there is no connection or correlation between cost and quality. If employers had this data, they could contract with the lowest cost and the highest quality providers and help their employees actually find the best quality at the lowest cost, and it would eventually start driving down those costs statewide. Hospitals tell me that they are struggling on costs. And I don't disbelieve that, and that they need more dollars from the state and the Medicaid side. And I would love my hospital partners to come to the table, be transparent in their pricing, my insurance partners to be transparent in their pricing. We have legislation for both of those. All payer claims database so that we can get a handle on the cost for my constituents. Because the saddest thing I see out there is people are not going to the doctor. They're not afraid of the diagnosis. They're afraid of medical bankruptcy. They're afraid of the cost. And then when they finally do go, their conditions are exacerbated, which again drives up costs, but it also really, people are going in too late. They're not catching things early enough, which then impacts their lives very negatively. It impacts our workforce. It's just very negative to the whole economy, both socially for people as well as financially. And that is not something we want. And it's something that we could address at the state level. That is something that we've had great conversations amongst our caucus. And I'm hoping that that's something that we can come together and really work on.
We're talking to Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski of Tomahawk. She'll serve as president of the state Senate in the next session. Senator Felskowski, a lot of eyes on Wisconsin's budget surplus, projected $4 billion-ish. You and Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu have both talked about your priorities for that. What is on your mind?
So the first thing, and I haven't sat down with Fiscal Bureau yet, it's kind of been a little bit of a whirlwind. I want to know, you know, how much of that budget surplus is one-time money, how much of that budget surplus is ongoing. If it's one-time money, we're going to do what we did last time. We're going to use it on one-time projects, infrastructure maintenance, not bonding, but we'll use it for capital build-out, capital projects. Reinvest in our parks, reinvest in maintenance on our capital buildings, you know, UW systems, instead of bonding. Just like we did last time. If it's ongoing, then we're going to look at how much of that is needed for continuing our state, moving our state forward. We know our Medicaid budget always picks up, you know, a large portion of our ongoing revenue. But then if we've got that kind of a surplus, we've taken too much from our taxpayers. So that's when we sit down with the Assembly and with the East Wing and we say, okay, we need to give some of this money back to our taxpayers.
That all rolls into
and how do we do that?
That all rolls into next year's state budget, the 2-year state budget, really the biggest job for state government. In addition to, you know, looking at the state of the surplus and looking at those tax cuts, what else is at the top of your priority list for the next state budget?
So I think, you know, it's moving Wisconsin forward. You know, we always like to throw money at things. And of course, we have our schools are our priority. Senior citizens are a priority. Roads are a priority. But it's not always about money. We have to make sure that we have the workforce out there to complete all the jobs. You know, healthcare, mental health is a priority, but we have to have providers, not just throw money at it. So there's going to be a lot of things. You know, we haven't sat down with our caucus. You know, elections were just last week. Everybody's, you know, getting reintroduced to everything. And we're going to sit down with our caucus members, have meetings with them, and, you know, gain ideas from our caucus. We'll have listening sessions with all of our constituents. And that's where we gain a lot of our ideas. See where that's at.
I want to talk about state and tribal relations. There's been this dispute between the Lac du Flambeau tribe and their local community over right of way. A very long story. You've been drawn into that in some cases. What do you see as the role of the state Senate in working with Wisconsin's tribes and building a positive relationship?
So I was just at the tribal committee yesterday up in Green Bay. I think the state has a very positive relationship with our tribal partners. You know, they have some ideas. We did some packages last year, housing packages. We're going to work to see if we can't include the tribes in that. There's some nuances to that. We have to work with WIDA in order to allow that to happen, and that's a long conversation. It's a little bit too long to go into. There's some caveats to that. And I think there's things that we can do as a state government to help the tribes and help them enrich the lives of their members. I think they do a good job now, but there's more that can be done. I'm very disappointed in the leadership at Lac du Flambeau. There's been numerous opportunities for them. They've called for meetings. You know, the state government has showed up for those meetings, and in the 24th hour, then they failed to show up. They keep moving the needle on what they're asking for. And in all honesty, when it comes to treaties, there isn't a lot the state can do. These are federal issues, and we don't have a lot of control. I applaud Governor Evers. He has gone there. He has tried to talk with them. He's tried to encourage them to come to the table and negotiate a sit-down and a final settlement. But the Chairman Johnson just doesn't seem to want to have that happen. So I think now this is going to have to be accomplished at the federal level with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and our representation, whether it's our congressional delegation or our senators. They're the ones that are going to actually have to make this happen. And I hope they do it soon, because Chairman Johnson is now threatening to add roads and throw the barricades up again in January. So I'm very saddened by it. At the tribal committee yesterday, I know that some of the other tribal members have expressed that they feel this is hurting tribal relations, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but in some of our neighboring states. And I don't disagree with that. I would like to see a resolution to that. It's very much affecting the people that live up there, both from a stress standpoint. It's very sad.
We'll leave it there for now. Senator Falskowski, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate the call. Thank you.
That's Republican State Senator Mary Falskowski of Tomahawk, who was recently elected president of the state Senate. We've been talking with her about the Senate's priorities for the new legislative session, including the state's health care system and the $4 billion budget surplus. Hey, elections are done. What questions do you want asked to your elected officials? Let us know about it. Our news team has a comment box up at WPR.org, or you can email us, wisconsintoday@WPR.org. That's wisconsintoday@WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new podcast series profiles a Green Bay Packers star who in retirement became entrenched in an extreme religious group.
Some of his former teammates really don't want to talk to him anymore. Everyone is very apprehensive about talking to him and even talking about him.
The NFL reporter on her series called Spiraled, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A former Green Bay Packers star is the subject of a new podcast series looking at former NFL players who have joined a controversial extreme religious group.
Kabir Abajabiamila broke the Green Bay Packers' all-time career sack record in 2007 and was inducted into the team's Hall of Fame in 2013.
But after his playing career, he became heavily involved with a religious group called Straightway Truth Ministries and started leading his own branch of the ministry in the Green Bay area.
He and some of his followers separated from family members. Some have been arrested, raising concerns about what his group is preaching.
Kaylin Kaler is a senior NFL reporter for ESPN and a Wisconsin native. Her new podcast series about Abajabiamila and Straightway Truth Ministries is called Spiraled. Kaylin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, thanks, Kate.
So tell us about this religious group, Straightway Truth Ministries, that Kabir and other former players have gotten involved with. What makes them so controversial?
Yeah, so Straightway Truth Ministries is led by a man named Charles Dowell. He calls himself Pastor Dowell, and he is a former member of the Army. He was in the Army for about 10 years, and then he started preaching out of his own home, and then later became connected with a group called The Overcomer. They are kind of modeled around like community-style living. So Dowell encourages his followers to move onto a property, a Straightway property. They've got about 12 or so communities across the country and one in Canada. And He encourages members to move onto those properties where they, you know, are kind of living isolated lives. They grow their own food. They do a lot of training with weapons. So they're very into self-defense. They identify as a nation of Hebrew Israelites, which is the belief that Black people are the true Israelites of the Bible and not the Jewish people as we know them. So it's an inherently anti-Semitic viewpoint because it's, you know, you're claiming the identity of Jewish people if you believe in Hebrew Israelism. So it lends itself to a lot of, you know, hateful ideas and, you know, espousing misogynistic views, homophobic views, anti-Semitic views, anti-government views. They align a lot with sovereign citizen ideology where, you know, you don't get a marriage license, you don't get a birth certificate for your children, you don't drive with license plates on your vehicle. And, you know, the life of a woman there, we've spoken to several of the wives or who are now ex-wives of the NFL players who joined in my podcast. I talked to Eileen Baja Biamila, who is now Eileen Bermundo Noyes, because she's remarried. But Eileen was not interested in joining this because, you know, she felt it was going to really change her life as a woman and the role that she would have in her marriage. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I heard from a lot of the women, because the women in Straightway have to cover their heads. They're not supposed to make eye contact with the men or speak unless they're spoken to. And so that is something that you see when you just look at Straightway's YouTube videos. You see that in the women that are portrayed in their videos.
Kabir starts a new family in his Straightway life. You talk with his ex-wife, Eileen, for the series. Does he have any relationship with that old life, so to speak, and his eight kids?
He really doesn't. And he's actually still never met his eighth child, because Eileen was pregnant. She found out she was pregnant with their eighth child, which was another son. They have one girl and seven boys. She found out she was pregnant with him the year that Kabir really got into Straightway, and Kabir wanted to take the whole family there. And Eileen was like, absolutely not. We're not going. And then he said, well, fine, I'm taking the kids. If you don't want to go, I'll take the kids. And she's like, no, you're not going to take the kids. So ultimately, she actually had to secretly leave. She had to plan. And she describes this in our podcast series. She had to, plan an escape route, essentially, because she felt like Kabir was going to go to Straightway, which is headquartered in Tennessee, and visit Straightway with their children. And she wasn't okay with that. She was not on board with this. And so she decided to kind of create an escape route. And so one day when Kabir went to Appleton for a business meeting, she had the kids leave their, they had Fitbits or something like a Fitbit, like a little tracker watch. She had them leave, take off their watches, leave them at the house so that Kabir wouldn't be able to see their location. And she and her seven children at the time, and at the time she didn't even know she was pregnant yet, they left and they went to Stevens Point to stay with a friend there and to stay at their house for the rest of the summer.
I wonder if you could step back for a moment. The podcast series is called Spiraled because of how players like Kabir start off okay, fine, slowly going deeper into religious extremism. How beloved was he in Green Bay during his playing career? And did his fellow players see this?
So Kabir was really a local hero. He was very involved in the community. He broke Reggie White's sack record in Green Bay, which is a big record. And so, you know, he's a well-known player, and he is actually one of the few players that stayed in Green Bay. You know, obviously Green Bay is it's the smallest NFL market. So a lot of players leave when their playing days are over, but Kabir actually stayed and he built a home there. And I think he was on the school board of his kids' private Christian school. And he was donated a lot of money to different causes in the community. And so he kind of built a reputation for himself. And when he was a player, his teammates, he had a different kind of reputation. He was very vocal about his Christianity, but in a different way than Reggie White was. Reggie White was also, you know, known as the Minister of Defense. And, you know, he played in Green Bay before Kabir, and Kabir really looked up to him. But Kabir was the player that, if you were in the locker room, if you were a teammate of his, like, you kind of would avoid him in the locker room because you didn't necessarily want to get into a Jesus conversation. And I've talked to even reporters who covered Kabir, during his playing days from 2000 to 2008 in Green Bay. And they tell similar stories of Kabir wanting to hand out religious pamphlets to them, wanting to turn every question, every conversation back to God. And you do hear that a lot in the NFL when you interview a player, especially post-game or pre-game. There's a lot of credit that goes to God and goes to evangelical Christianity is a really big influence on the NFL. But Kabir really took it further than most players would. And he was very judgmental of his teammates. I talked to several of his former teammates who, you know, said he would often comment on players who were going through divorces or who even just drank alcohol or, you know, went out and partied. These were things that he saw as being biblically wrong because he had a very black and white view on what was right and what was wrong. And there was no gray area with Kabir. It was this or that because, you know, he just really cared. He cared so much about all of his teammates being saved religiously that he would just take it. He would cross the line a lot of times in conversations with them.
We're talking with ESPN senior NFL reporter Kaylin Kaler about her new podcast series. It's about former Green Bay Packers star Kabir Bajabiamila and his involvement with a controversial extreme religious group. So Kabir, as you mentioned, remains active with spreading his religious message on his YouTube channel, where he says he's providing biblical solutions to real life challenges. Let's listen to a clip from a recent video where he talks about the isolation that has come from following his beliefs.
You know why the world can't hear me? Because I'm no longer belong to the world. See, when I was of the world heard me. Now they can't hear me anymore. That's why the Packers don't call me, because the Packers was part of the world. The people that I used to run with or fellowship with or whatever, they can't hear me anymore. Don't be mad when they don't want to fellowship with you and don't want to talk to you anymore. It's a good thing. That means it's a sign that you're walking in the right path.
What is Kabir's YouTube channel like, or how has it informed your podcast?
Yeah, so one of the interesting parts about reporting this is that, you know, Kabir did sit down with me for about 6 hours for the written story for Sports Illustrated that I did on this. But for the podcast, he didn't want to talk anymore. I had a few, you know, off the record conversations with him, and he just felt like there was nothing new for him to say because nothing had changed in what he believes and where he stands on things. And so the great thing about that is that you can go to his YouTube and you can get all of his thoughts. They're all right there for you. And there's almost like nothing more that you need to ask him because he's put it all out there. And he does love to say like the persecution that he feels he faces, where, you know, some of his former teammates really don't want to talk to him anymore. Everyone is very apprehensive about talking to him and even talking about him. I had a hard time getting former teammates to sit down for this podcast because they just don't really want anything to do with it because they're not sure what this group is about. They have a lot of questions, and there's some fear associated with it as well, because the whole reason I got into this story was a very strange incident that happened in December in 2019.
So 5 years ago, yeah, in Green Bay. Can you talk about that moment where, you know, two of Kabir's religious followers are arrested in Green Bay and what this was like at a Christmas pageant?
Yeah, it was super, super odd. And that's how I got turned on to the story. I saw the Green Bay Press Gazette wrote about it. And so essentially what happened is that Kabir no longer viewed Christmas as something he believed in. He thought it was a pagan holiday. So his kids participating in a Christmas show bothered him. And he made that known to the school's principal. His kids went to a Christian school in Green Bay. So he made that known in several phone calls with the school principal leading up to the Christmas show. And the principal said, you know, there's nothing I can do. Eileen wants the kids in it. The kids are going to be in it. Eileen, basically, the kids are living with Eileen. What do you want me to do? And so in one of those later phone calls, the day of the Christmas show, Kabir said to the school's principal, you know, because the school's principal had asked him if he was threatening him. And Kabir said, no, you don't need to worry about me. Black people don't shoot up schools. White people do. And so fast forward to that evening at the Christmas show, two men who are part of Straightway, who are both white men, show up in the church and in the audience. And they don't have kids in the show. And so the school's principal is very worried about that. He starts panicking. Well, what does this mean? What are they here for? And he remembers what Kabir said to him earlier that day. So he calls the police. The police end up arresting the two men for trespassing on the school's Christmas show. And Kabir shows up. He's not arrested, but he has conversations with the police officers. And then the police also discover, after searching the men, that they're both carrying weapons without a license to carry. So that became a very scary moment for parents in that school community because, imagine two strange men who don't have kids in the school showing up with guns, and you don't know what they're there for.
And what's interesting about that particular moment, I'm thinking there are no guns, there are no assault rifles in the pages of the Old Testament. If they follow the Bible literally, why are weapons in their ministry?
There's weapons because Dowell has decided that, and he has chosen scripture to support his reasoning. Straightway Truth Ministry is a really interesting group to follow because it is a total mashup of whatever Charles Dowell believes, and he will find scripture to support it. So one example I like to give is that they weren't always practicing polygyny, which is the practice of a man having more than one wife. They didn't always believe in that, but several years into the existence of Straightway, Dowell decided he believed in polygyny. And so he started introducing that to his to the Straightway members, they call them the saints. He started introducing that idea to the saints. And obviously there were many people who left because they didn't agree with that. But over time, he, established a group that does believe in that and does want to practice that. And that was several people who have been part of Straightway told me that that was prompted because Dowell was interested in someone else's wife in the community, and he wanted to have a second wife. And so that's something that Dowell being, particularly with the weapons, Dowell being in the army for 10 years, having trained in weapons training, I think that's just something that he believes in as a core philosophy of his. And it kind of goes hand in hand with their anti-government ideology. They want to be trained in self-defense, and they're always saying this on YouTube, like, they're prepared if anyone wants to start something with them. They want to be able to defend themselves.
What might Kabir's branch of the ministry be like in Green Bay?
Yeah, so in Green Bay, he has a giant, giant home. It has something like 22 bathrooms, I want to say, and probably a similar number of bedrooms. And they have a giant gym. They've got more than one house on the property. He built this property when he was an NFL player for the Packers, and he built it with ministry in mind. Originally, that was the Christian ministry, the evangelical Christian ministry. They wanted to be able to host pastors, host people who are coming into town for church-related events and things like that, and host fundraisers and, kids over, sporting events, all of that. And what it's turned into now is the Straightway Truth Ministry branch in Green Bay. And so I don't know exactly how many people are living on the property, but if you watch Kabir's YouTube channel, that appears to be like a good number that are at least coming there and staying for the Sabbath, which they practice the Sabbath on Saturdays.
Would these be former NFL players? Who might they be?
They are, I think, just regular people. There's at least one former NFL player, TJ Clemmings, who used to play for the Vikings, who got interested in Straightway about 3 years ago and has a very similar story to Kabir. He was not a known player. He had a much less successful NFL career, but the first Straightway location that he visited, because he was in Minneapolis, was Kabir's in Green Bay, because that was, geographically closest to him. I don't know if TJ lives there currently or if he's living on a different Straightway property, but he is pictured in some of Kabir's Facebook photos, and I've seen him in some of the videos, but I don't have any way of actually knowing if he lives there. But he is an ex-NFL player who became interested in Straightway after Kabir, and then Kabir was a mentor to him. And TJ now never met his triplets that were born a couple of years ago. They were born the year that he became interested in Straightway, and he's never met them because he is also now divorced from his wife and, hasn't seen his 5 children since he decided to become interested in Straightway.
I wonder, it seems like Green Bay has such a close-knit bond with players. Players develop a very close relationship with the city, perhaps because of its size. How does Green Bay feel about Kabir now?
Yeah. So I, at the time when I was reporting this in, you know, late 2019 and then the first half of 2020, when I first really started digging in on the story, there was a lot of apprehension because of what had just happened at that Christmas show. There was a lot of fear. You know, I met with two parents that had kids at the school, and we met at a local coffee shop, and they were really on edge, you could tell. And this was probably 2 weeks after the Christmas show incident had occurred. So it was very fresh. And I just felt like they were kind of whispering, because Green Bay is a small town and a lot of people know each other. And so they were, I think, very nervous to be speaking about their perspective on this. And I think Kabir actually has had his house on the market now for at least 2 years. And I don't know who is going to buy a property like that. That is a very unique place. And so I think he's had trouble selling it. But when I spoke to him for the Sports Illustrated story in 2020, he talked a lot about how he wants to leave Green Bay because he feels that people judge him now. And he feels he's always felt that he's experienced racism there. And he feels like now, especially because he's part of that, especially because he's left, you know, the most acceptable form of religion, which is, you know, evangelical Christianity, which is, you know, often aligned with predominantly white demographic, he feels, you know, he's been ostracized a little bit. And you could hear that in that clip you played from his YouTube.
Kaylin, thank you for joining us and for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much for wanting to talk about Spiral. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, iHeart Media, and anywhere you get your podcasts, like Spotify as well.
Kaylin Kaler is a senior NFL reporter for ESPN. She was with us to share her new narrative podcast series called Spiraled, about former Green Bay Packers player Kabir Bajabiamila's involvement in a controversial extreme religious group here in Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, hear the often overlooked story behind the Red Arrow Division, one of the most active units in World War II with roots in the Wisconsin and Michigan National Guards.
It wasn't like the movies. It wasn't like a training exercise. This was for real, and a slip-up meant death or injury.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. One of the most active and effective combat units in the Pacific Theater during World War II had origins right here in Wisconsin. But the story of the unit and the Wisconsinites who fought in it is often overshadowed in historical memory.
The 32nd Red Arrow Infantry Division was the first U.S. Army division to take the offensive against the Japanese military and the first to defeat them in battle. In total, they racked up 654 days of fighting, more than any other U.S. Army division during World War II.
The division was formed around National Guard units from Wisconsin and Michigan. If you keep an eye out, you can see traces of the Red Arrow Division all over Wisconsin, from memorials to park names and red arrows that appear on signs for Wisconsin Highway 32.
A new book by an author with Wisconsin roots tells the story of the Red Arrow Division from the perspective of the soldiers themselves.
Mark D. Van Els is a professor of history at Queensborough Community College of the City University of New York. He grew up in Manitowoc. He's the author of several books. His newest out this week is called Red Arrow Across the Pacific, the 32nd Infantry Division During World War II. Mark, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
What made you want to tackle this story of the Red Arrow Division, the 32nd Infantry Division, and their experiences during World War II?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons. I've always been interested in the lives of ordinary soldiers during the Second World War. I grew up in Wisconsin, and the 32nd Division was made up of National Guard soldiers from Wisconsin and Michigan, so they're sort of a local connection, a local interest. And as I started to study history professionally, I noticed that not much had been written about the Red Arrow Division. It seemed to be everywhere in the Pacific. It was the first U.S. Army division to go into battle against the Japanese. It ended the war on occupation duty in Japan, and it finally wasn't demobilized until 1946. And yet there really wasn't that much written about the division. It seemed like there was a missing story there. And so I wanted to continue my exploration of the ordinary GI, explore my interest in Wisconsin history in particular, and perhaps add the Red Arrow Division to the larger story of America's World War II in the Pacific.
And something I really appreciated about the book is, you know, sometimes when you read a history of a division, we start in theater. They're at war already. You really bring it back to the origins. These are regular people, mostly at the outset from Michigan and Wisconsin, thrust into a very unordinary situation. Why is it so important for us to remember that reality of the troops who were serving?
Well, I think we do need to remember that they come from our communities, that they're members of our families, and some members of our families and communities have been through some very difficult times, and they're the ones who defend us in times of trouble. In World War II, we were attacked. The war, most people supported the conflict. So they're members of our families and members of our community who are asked to do extraordinary things to defend the country.
I want to talk a little bit about the origins of the unit. Now, first of all, this is a division formed out of National Guard units in the Midwest, yes. Not a regular Army unit, which causes conflict and contention as the story goes on. Tell us a little bit about the Red Arrow, how it got its name and how it is formed.
Well, the Red Arrow Division was formed during the First World War. The United States Army went through a major reorganization in preparation to fight that conflict. They developed permanent numbered divisions for the first time, and Wisconsin and Michigan soldiers were organized into the 32nd Division. It trained at Camp MacArthur in Texas and then shipped off to France, participated in some of the most important battles in the First World War, gained a reputation as one of the United States' most effective combat divisions during the war, including the Meuse-Argonne offensive that finally brought that conflict to an end, and then served on occupation duty in Germany for a period after the First World War. The division then came home between the wars, took part in the standard sorts of duties that the National Guard does. When tornadoes and fires break out, for example, the National Guard is called to duty. There were labor disturbances in the 1930s that the National Guard was called up for occasionally. And the National Guard conducted its usual training, although as World War II started to brew, it became pretty clear that the training that the soldiers were receiving was not really preparing them for the massive conflict that was coming.
And the name Red Arrow came from their success in World War I, right? That was the symbol of their ability to break through enemy lines.
It did, yes. They punctured every German line during the First World War, and that's where the Red Arrow symbol came from. You see that red arrow pointing upward. You see the horizontal bar across the middle of it. That was meant to symbolize that they crossed over every German line.
You share so many stories of so many people. I'm wondering if I can bring up one name, Clarence Youngworth of Oshkosh. You refer to his diary, a well-known World War II diary of his experiences, a legend in Oshkosh. He passed away just 6 years ago, sadly. I never got a chance to interview him myself. Can you tell us a little bit about Clarence and how much of this story he was able to share?
He was one of the more interesting stories that I read, I think, particularly because he seemed like a very ordinary person. He was a kid in the Great Depression. As he describes, he joined the National Guard to make a little money, as many young men did in the 1930s. He became a company clerk for Company H of the 127th Infantry Regiment. His only qualification for that seemed to be that he took a class in typing in high school. That seemed to make him qualified to be the company clerk. And then, like everyone else in the division, was thrown into this titanic conflict. They went to training in Louisiana. They went to Australia, their first foreign country, and then thrown into battle in New Guinea in 1942.
We're talking about World War II history, the history of the Red Arrow Division, largely from Wisconsin originally. Mark D. Van Els is with us. His new book is called Red Arrow Across the Pacific, the 32nd Infantry Division During World War II. Mark, that first deployment in Papua New Guinea, some of the most brutal terrain in the world, going up against experienced Japanese veteran forces at that point in the war. And I was just shocked to read how the training for jungle combat hadn't been there. The uniforms, the boots, the equipment wasn't there. What kind of position was Red Arrow put in when they were deployed to this very, very difficult combat zone?
I think it's fair to say an impossible position. As you noted, they did not have the training. They did not yet have the equipment. I think it's also fair to say that those and the top of the chain of command also did not understand what they were getting into. Very few Americans had ever been to New Guinea. They didn't really understand the jungle environment. And American troops, the Red Arrow, perhaps more so than most, went into battle very, very confident. They believed a lot in that reputation of the First World War, that they had pierced every line. They believed themselves to be ready to fight the war. They also had some very faulty intelligence and didn't quite understand just how many Japanese troops that they were facing. And so they went in perhaps overconfident in this very difficult environment against veteran soldiers, as you mentioned. They ultimately did prevail. Mm-hmm. But those first few days on the battlefield, these soldiers had to learn some really tough lessons about what fighting is actually like, what combat is actually like. It wasn't like the movies. It wasn't like a training exercise. This was for real, and a slip-up meant death or injury. And there were some very tough lessons that the division members had to learn to ultimately prevail in that battle and all the others that followed.
Mark, before we follow them onto that first battlefield, one of the training pamphlets they got warned that they were facing two enemies, the Japanese army and nature. And nature might be the more deadly. Incredible marches through mountains and being bivouacked in jungle territory, swamp territory. How much was just disease and nature a formidable enemy for them?
Malaria in particular was a massive problem with the 32nd Division. And being the first U.S. Army infantry division to go in, they suffered perhaps more from malaria than any other division in the entire U.S. Army. The preventive measures hadn't been developed yet. The drugs to treat malaria were inadequate. As you noted, they're camped outside in these jungles, going through the mountains, constantly being bitten by mosquitoes. Most members of the division ended up suffering from malaria by the time this conflict, by the time this battle was over, which meant high fevers, chills. Some died as a result of it. And here again, the U.S. Army was really unprepared for what it would take to win the war in the Pacific.
And in that state, they go into a battle against this prepared Japanese position, one of the many spots on islands seen as key to turning the tide in the Pacific. They are having to advance through water, through bogs, through jungle, Japanese bunkers with interlocking fields of fire. without so much of the equipment we think of when we think of World War II combat, tanks, lots of artillery, air support. They didn't have it in those at the beginning of this battle. Can you talk about what they faced trying to assault this heavily fortified position with just guns and grenades?
Well, I think you described it pretty well right there. There were no tanks until late in the battle. It was very difficult. New Guinea is a place with the very dense jungles, no real road network, no port system. So just a matter of transporting heavy equipment like that was a very difficult thing to do. They did not have much artillery support. Here in this case, leaders at the top of the chain of command believed that they could use airplanes to provide the artillery support, and that turned out not to be adequate enough. The Japanese, meanwhile, had built these very well-camouflaged fortifications, entrenchment systems, in some cases reinforced by cement and steel doors and these sorts of things. Going through these swamps, there were only certain pathways you could take, and the Japanese concentrated their defenses there. And with the weapons that they had, the mortars, the grenades, the rifles, they were not able to punch through most of these defenses. Not until the tanks came in were they really able to make substantial headway at Buna.
I want to go back to Clarence Youngworth of Oshkosh, because you give the last word in the book to him. And I'm going to read his quote that you end with and see if I can hold it together here. "We were just ordinary citizens from all walks of life that were given a job to do. And we did it to the best of our ability. Sometimes we liked the job. Sometimes we hated it. We grew up in combat. We didn't consider ourselves heroes. What we did for the love of our families and our country." And reading the book, I try to think about what kept them going? What kept them motivated? If I put myself there at any age, I don't know if I would have made it, certainly. As you've lived and experienced and read these guys' words, what do you make of what kept them going?
Well, there are a number of things. Studies of soldiers in war oftentimes suggest that soldiers fight for each other more than anything else. If you let your comrades down in battle, others might be killed. And that's a great motivating factor for you to keep fighting and do extraordinary heroic things. Just those bonds that occur between soldiers. To succeed in combat takes teamwork. So those bonds are very, very powerful. I don't think we can dismiss the idea of patriotism and love of country either. Remember, the United States entered World War II with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Those feelings were very, very high.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this important chapter in Wisconsin history.
Thank you for having me.
Mark D. Van Els is a professor of history at Queensborough Community College at the City University of New York. We talked to him about his new book. It's called Red Arrow Across the Pacific, the 32nd Infantry Division during World War II. It tells the story of one of the most prominent combat units in the Pacific Theater during World War II, with origins here in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Now, regular listeners to WPR know that Rob Ferret is a big fan of live nature webcams. Is that right, Rob?
It is true. They may be the best use of the internet so far, as far as I'm concerned.
And yesterday, I was the first to hear that you had found a live nature cam right here in Wisconsin that you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, it's the Trempealeau Eagles camera. It's got a view of an eagle's nest overlooking the Mississippi River. It's run by the Raptor Resource Project. It just went live on Tuesday at the website explorer.org, but they had the live stream on their website starting last fall.
And so the big question often have you seen eagles live on camera?
I caught one of the nesting pair yesterday. They're known as Mr. and Mrs. T. I think I saw Mrs. T. Don't quote me on that. I love nature cams. I'm bad at identifying nature.
Well, are you hooked on nature cams like Rob here, or do you live where you can see eagles in real life? Either way, get in touch. Let us know. Call 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. All I have to say is keep calm and nature webcam on.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is WPR News.